What we want to talk about is the Trident Scientific Workflow Workbench, I think is what it's called now, right? Why don't you kind of give us the 50,000 foot overview, and then we'll sort of zoom in on why and how.
One of the main motivations for this project is that scientists are having to deal with large volumes of data coming from disparate data sources. Typically, this has been a labor-intensive process, and typically the amount of data they've had to deal with has been manageable. There were postdocs that could basically convert the raw data from these instruments into readable formats. A manual workflow was in place to actually process the data into usable data products, and the time was often measured in weeks or even in months going from raw data to actual usable data products.
Yeah, those were the good
Yeah.
old days, but that was
Those are the good ones. That's right.
then. Or maybe
And
not so good.
our ability to capture data has outpaced our ability to process and to visualize this data, and it's rising exponentially with the cheap sensors, rapid deployment of sensors, the size of the instruments we're able to create, etc. Neptune is just simply one example of this. Astronomy and all the sciences are examples of the scale of the models that they're creating, the scale of the deployment of the sensors, and the type of analysis that the scientist is trying to attack.
Right. So you mentioned Neptune. Neptune is the University of Washington's oceanographic project.
It's actually an NSF. The proper name for it is an Ocean Observing Initiative. It's
Okay.
being funded by the NSF. For several hundred million dollars. The University of Washington is one of the partners, Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute, and a number of coastal observatories as well are
Okay.
part of this large program.
So I guess it got going in earnest around sort of the turn of the century.
Indeed.
The turn of the century—that's a funny thing to say. But since then, they've got fiber optic cables laid, and there's lots of ocean data that's pouring in.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, and
It's actually transformed oceanography from a data poor science to a data rich science. And that actually is part of the problem. It's part of the solution is that they're going to be able to monitor what's going on in the oceans 24/7 for long periods of time. So the kind of processes that they can start to study, they've not been able to study or monitor before. They've only been able to go out to the ocean at these episodic events or whenever they could get funding. Whenever there's an earthquake, whenever the funding would allow, they would go out in a boat and actually gather data. But now they're going to be out there permanently.
so what's the scope of the sensor network as of right now?
The scope is they're actually laying the trench down at Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute for testing out the actual sensor nodes and deployments and the practices of deploying it. NSF is currently reviewing the larger program and getting ready to start supplying funding for the Neptune Array, which will be off the coast of Washington and Oregon. The Canadian version of the Neptune Array is actually up and running, and they're collecting data, but the software infrastructure is still being built as we speak.
And what kind of quantities of data is the, and well, the one that's active right now, the Canadian one, producing?
Gigabytes per day. It can easily handle a couple of high-definition TV channels being simultaneously broadcast from video high-definition video cameras on the ocean floor.
So, in addition to temperature and,
Humidity,
wave activity and
depth.
things like that, it's actually sending back video?
Yes, actually sending back video. They actually can have in-situ sequencing devices that can actually sequence organisms out on the ocean. I mean, it really is like taking not only taking internet and power out to the ocean, but also a USB-like device where the instruments can be plugged in to the ocean, tested, and brought back in to be tuned. So experimental instruments are being put out there as well.
Okay. So what are some of the kinds of experiments that become possible with this sensor array? And then, sort of lead us into the challenges associated with managing the data that those experiments produce.
Being able to understand sediment flows across the ocean floor, talking about how temperature and salinity changes, how fresh water influx is coming in, like from the Columbia River or from rivers, how deep they penetrate, how far does the salinity level change, to try to understand the life that actually lives at those borders or at those margins.
Okay.
Because, of course, there's the sunlight penetrating into the ocean. There's actually an interesting narrow band where life is really thriving in the ocean. Too high up, and the tides actually affect it too far down, and they don't get enough light. So really understanding that narrow that band, if you will, is one of the key things they're looking at. But really, there's a myriad of things they're looking at
Okay.
with this equipment.
So an experiment in this data-intensive new world has something to do with formulating a hypothesis, looking for patterns, let's say in the already collected data that may support that hypothesis, mm-hmm. and then seeing
yep.
whether, you know, data collected in the future supports the hypothesis, right? So there's an element here of needing to be able to not just, you know, run an analysis on data, but be able to repeatedly run an analysis on
That's
the
right.
same or on an evolving collection of data sets, right? And that,
exactly.
I think, has a sort of a lot to do with this workflow aspect of what you've been doing.
That's right. Indeed. And even being able to tune their models over time, because at the end of the day, if they could have, a lot of the oceanographers will tell you, if they can actually learn how to calibrate and tune their models by actually being able to monitor the ocean for long periods of time, that will take out a lot of uncertainty in how we understand our oceans. Whereas it is right now, the data points are so sparse, we don't know if it's just a lack of data, if the model's correct, or if it's just, or if the data just hasn't been captured correctly.
And I guess there's also the question of, you know, as your understanding of the data set evolves and your models based on that evolve, right? You then need to kind of compensate for that in terms of what you're measuring and how you're interpreting. So what is it that you've built, and, you know, how does it help to do those things?
Jim Gray was the first person who had this vision of an oceanographer's workbench. And what his insight was is that scientists really want to interact with visualizations of the ocean, with models, and that's how they understand their world. And however, going from raw data coming off these sensors to these visualizations was a gap that was missing. And this is, you know, managing information, managing data is one of the strengths of Microsoft. And so our motivation was in external research is we actually try to look for partnerships like this where we can bring our technology, we can learn from applying it to really what I'll call data-intensive stress tests that even our commercial products are not dealing with this much data, and try to extend our technology or use our technology to provide a solution. Jim pointed out that workflow would be a key to this. In addition, there'd be databases to store it, but workflow is the missing ingredient. So we looked at the workflow tools we had available in-house. Windows Workflow was the workflow engine of choice in the company, the one that we're building on top of going forward.
Right. Now, of course, that didn't exist at the time that Jim, I think, was making these proposals, right? It's a relatively recent addition to the suite, but...
The name is, but in fact, it wasn't. In fact, in alpha and beta formats and being used internally, and Jim knew I was actually doing some of my research on top of Windows Workflow.
Okay.
At the time, and so, of course, he was leaving the solution up to us. He was just identifying where the need was, and workflows he identified as accurately as being a way that the scientists could not only articulate the science, the transforms that needed to take place, but they could also share them, reuse them, and so it needed to be more than just a one-off solution, but in fact, we could build a library of solutions that other scientists could use.
Mm-hmm.
And so... And if you look at how Microsoft works as a company, I mean, we build platforms and we expect ISVs or partners to step in and actually bridge that gap between our platform and the user community. And so that's really the role our group has played, is that we're looking at the requirements of the scientists, we're looking at the platform that Microsoft provides, we're building on top of that platform to provide a custom solution to the scientists that will hopefully, you know, accelerate their research or change the way they're able to do their science. And so that's the high bar we've held for this project, is not just do it faster, not just make it based on Microsoft products, but give them something they could not do before and can hopefully impact or change the way they can do their science, the kind of questions they can ask. So that was the motivation for the project. We partnered up initially with the University of Washington and Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute. AMBARI, as they're known, they're actually gathering data from sensors, from ROVs. They could tell us the spectrum of data that we would have to handle. We'd have to be able to ingest into our workflows.
Mm-hmm.
The University of Washington has a visualization tool called COVE, which the scientists are readily adopting as the way they would like to look at the ocean floor. You can think of it as virtual Earth for the ocean.
Okay.
It has bathymetry data so that as you're cruising along the western coast or anywhere in the world, really, if there's a bathymetry data set, they're able to pull them in so you can see the ocean floor.
So what are the kinds of data transformations that need to happen in order to get from what the sensor array puts out to what COVE can consume and display?
So first off, there's probably about 24 different data sources that we have to be able to ingest based on the instruments and based on the type of data these instruments put out. At the high end, we're talking about high definition, you know, streaming data coming from a video camera, streaming data coming from an instrument, or just in net CDF format or some common format the scientists or the instrument designers have created. So one of the very first transformations we have to be able to do is to realize what kind of data format this instrument or this model is kicking out and be able to transform it into an internal data structure that we can then operate on inside of our tool.
Okay. So you mentioned NetCDF. I don't know what that is.
Yes. Yeah. So that's a self-describing data format. It predates XML. And basically, it has a binary representation, but it also has a serial representation, which is self-describing. So the headers will actually have certain key values, and it will tell you how the rest of the data file is laid out.
Okay.
And so, in fact, most of the daily models or the daily forecasts or even some of the daily sensor readings that the oceanographers are using are packed up in NetCDF format and put on servers that the community can download.
Is that an oceanography thing or just generally an instrumentation thing?
It's actually being used across multiple scientists. There's probably 6 of these common data formats that the scientists have adopted for sharing data. They've been doing this, you know, for decades. I think I first encountered NetCDF about 15, 20 years ago. So okay. It's been around for a long time.
But the workflow engine is, you know, abstracted from any of those formats and from any of the visualization tools, right? It's just a mechanism for being able to reproducibly run transformations and understand, what happened when and so on. And so, you know, so talk about the workflow sort of guts of the thing.
I mean, we can talk about what the workflow engine provides, but we'll maybe start with how we started our interactions with the scientist. This is really in response to Jim Gray's nice work on, he would ask scientists, what are the 20 queries that you want to ask? Mm-hmm. And from that, he'd get an understanding of how they viewed the data and what kind of processing was required. We took the same approach and asked the scientists, what are the 20 workflows that you would like for us to create? Or what are the 20 visualizations that you would like to see? And from this, and we went through each one in painstaking detail, from high-end visualization all the way down to the data sets that they'd need to be able to attach to. And in between, we would talk about the kinds of transforms and the kinds of data integration that would have to take place because you're reading data from multiple sensors or you're actually calibrating a model with the data. And what we found is when we were done with all 20 of those workflows, we actually had a set of about 24 transformations that were common across all of these workflows. And that became the library of activities, reusable chunks of code that the scientists could then draw upon to actually not only author these 20 workflows, but the next 20.
So could you give just a couple of examples in a way that would make sense to a layperson?
Sure. For example, regridding. You have two data sets, one's from a model and one is from actually deployment of a set of sensors out on the ocean that are on different grid coordinate systems, and you need to be able to bring those two together. So that may require some interpolation, may require you drop some data points or add data points to different data sets, unioning of different data sets. For example, yes, I can go to a server and I can get the salinity and temperature for a given day, but I'd like to do that for 20 days. So it requires that you union all those data sets and then give me an average or a high and a low, or I want to be able to click a single point in the ocean and actually see the high temperature and the low temperature. Well, that requires for a period of time. Well, that requires you kind of turn that into a query over these servers, do transformations. Some of the instruments are in a different coordinate system. You'd have to transform the coordinates and then do the aggregation operations.
I guess there might be a kind of a temporal variant of the spatial regridding as well, right? I mean, matching up different timescales.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Some instruments are getting things on every second. Some are getting things every 15 minutes, and you're being asked to compute an average. You can then ask the user, do you want interpolation to take place? Would you like us just to match up the points? And then based on these inputs, the workflow gets configured, and they see the resulting visualization for the region of ocean they're interested in.
So it sounds like some of these primitives that have emerged from this are going to wind up being fairly general, you know, not just specific to oceanography.
Indeed they are. We actually anticipate that so while we produce a version of Trident for oceanography, many of these activities could be useful for other science as well. Anybody in the earth sciences are also using NetCDF in many of these same operations for talking about moisture in the atmosphere, for example. So we actually expect by building a tool which is both extensible and actually agnostic in terms of the science that it's supporting. You could actually imagine scientists who are understanding the interaction between wet oceans and warm air currents could actually use a tool like Triton in the future. And so that was the core, is actually how do we, understanding the key workflows, a starter kit of activities. So not only do we have, you know, the key 20 end-to-end workflows, but all the activities that led to that, which could lead to another set of workflows, but infrastructure which is extensible. So when a user starts up Triton, to scientists, what we heard is that the authoring experience for scientists is much different than that of, say, business workflow. In business workflow, you would have your accountant write your expense report workflow. They would lock it down, and they'd deploy it, and everybody would use it from that point on. And nobody would touch it until it came back for bug fixes or enhancements, you know, a year later. And what we found out with scientists is they actually want to borrow somebody's workflow. That's the key way of authoring, is really by plagiarism. Find somebody else's workflow that does what you want or close to it, load that workflow, and then start authoring from that point on. And so we implemented that capability in Triton, is that you can search for workflows by their purpose or by the kind of inputs that they process or by what goal they help you accomplish. And we'll return a list of those workflows. You can click on one, load it into a visual browser, because that's another thing we've noticed, is that the key oceanographers, while they understand the purpose of a workflow or of the code, they don't really want to see C# or Java. They want to see something visual, you know, boxes that represent the transformations they want to apply.
Sure. So we've been using the term workflow here, and you've mentioned Windows Workflow Foundation, but we haven't necessarily spelled out what that means. And so for someone who's not familiar with that platform, how would you sort of briefly characterize it? I mean, how would you say it is like and unlike the concepts of, let's say, script and script execution engine?
So what's unique about workflow versus scripting engines is, with workflow, you tease apart the notion of a schedule, which is the step of a sequence of actions that you would like to have performed. Now, if you were to look inside each one of those steps, you'd almost see code very similar to what you'd find in a script. But in addition to having a script or a sequence of steps, you have an orchestration engine, which, when you pass this workflow, the schedule, over to the scheduling engine, it opens up what's inside of each one of the boxes, executes the code inside of it. Again, that code would be very analogous to what you'd find in a script. But once it's completed that step, it goes back to the orchestration engine and says, well, what's next? And of course, if we'd just simply taken our script and written it as a workflow, we'd have a sequence of steps. We'd have broken our script down into a sequence of steps. But we have an abstraction layer. We have a scheduling engine, which is now able to actually walk through that for us. We've opened up an opportunity for reuse, that somebody can use those small steps or, you know, activities in the script as reusable building blocks for doing their own work. In addition, we can tie functionality on top of the orchestration engine. For example, it can tell us how far into the script we're executing, or we can change the way we do execution. We could run things in parallel, or tell it, I want to run that sequential now. Or guess what? I've got a multi-core machine behind me. Run all of these blocks in parallel. So that level of abstraction gives you a lot of power, and it gives you a chance to do reuse as well.
I guess there's also an aspect here of, one of the things that struck me when I first started learning a little bit about the Workflow Foundation was the way in which workflows can be very big or very small, right? I mean, they can be as small as the sequence of interactions with a form on a web page, right? And can be encapsulated entirely in the what you called orchestration engine can be encapsulated entirely within just the code that's behind that web page. So it can be a very tiny thing, or it can be a very big thing, and since it is, grounded in the .NET framework, right? That can exist in a variety of places. And so it can actually be running locally on a laptop. It can be running on a server in the cloud. And so there's an interesting amount of flexibility in terms of how these can be deployed. And I think also you mentioned in a talk that you gave that that an application therefore could consider, you know, embedding Triton, this workflow engine, right? Or it could be used in other modes, like as a service.
That's right. I mean, that really is the magic of this. I think you've hit on something which is really, we're just now starting to appreciate the potential of workflow. Yes, it could be hosted in an environment completely that's comfortable, that the scientists are comfortable with. You could hide the workflow completely behind the covers, or for a big institution, you could post it up as a service. Mm-hmm. and say this is something we're offering to the community and anybody with a web browser. And in fact, that's also been part of our mantra here, is that if we provide this to the scientists, we have to make sure they can interoperate with the tools that they're comfortable with using. Mm-hmm. And so you should be able to, you know, launch up your Linux box that runs a Firefox browser or Mozilla and be able to interact with this tool.
Mm-hmm.
But hitting on the second thing you said is that when you think about the workflow itself, we're experimenting here internally with having, you know, workflows that are resource seeking. That is to say, you could launch a workflow, perhaps even on your cell phone, and that scheduling engine is going to look for, gosh, where, what system do I know about has resources for this workflow, and let me migrate that workflow. Mm. Since that's a big chunk, I'm already controlling where it gets executed. I'll go ahead and actually execute it somewhere else and give the user on the cell phone a the impression it's running here locally, but in fact I've dispatched it to run somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of mobility of work, if you will, is, I think, going to be incredibly powerful going forward.
There's one more aspect of this which I want to kind of bring out, and that is that, so you mentioned that because the stuff is constructed using this workflow technology, mm-hmm. it kind of forces a degree of componentization. So
yes.
Things are broken down into steps, and the steps, mm-hmm. you know, it just sort of forces this discipline of modularity, which you might not necessarily get, mm-hmm. you know, in a kind of conventional scripting environment. And it also, you know, provides a degree of monitoring and control, and also, I think, significantly auditing in terms of the way that those components get used. And why this is, I think, so important in this environment is this, you know, sort of back to this idea of reproducibility, right? You know, so
yes.
A friend of mine is an HPC expert, and his one of his pet peeves is that when people look at HPC, they just tend to look at, you know, how much raw horsepower can we throw at a problem. And mm-hmm. he says, you know, who's worrying about reproducibility and correctness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and it's just a really important question. So, you know, as I understand it, in this environment, you know, you sort of naturally, one of the things that naturally falls out is an ability to be able to capture and replay and analyze, you know, what happened in this
yes.
workflow, right? And
yes.
to be able to, you know, reproduce a set of steps faithfully, and, you know, and that's, you know, that's sort of very much actually, you know, going back to what couldn't science do before. You know, it wasn't only that science couldn't analyze large quantities of data, it was also that science couldn't actually automate its own methods and be able to sort of reflect on them in this automated way, right? Which I think is
yeah.
really important.
Yeah, it is, and it's actually surprising. A value add is, even if we can't run the workflow faster, or even if the amount of data that they're dealing with is just the same, it's been one of our key features is to be able to support provenance, and we're really excited about this feature.
And explain what you mean by provenance.
Sure. Provenance is the ability for a particular result, and in fact, provenance, it's best thought of initially thinking about art, is that for a given piece of art, we're able to actually establish through authorities that this is an original piece of art, where it came from, and basically who's had their hands on it through its lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
So we can establish trust and basically that this art is authentic. Well, provenance for a workflow result is the very same thing. At a minimum level, we want to be able to establish trust in a result. And if you think about how scientists establish trust, is that they often trust starts at, well, who wrote this workflow?
Mm-hmm.
So with Trident, you can click at a result. You can click on a result, and we can basically show you, well, who wrote the workflow. We can allow you to interrogate the history of the workflow, who's revised it, who's reviewed it,
mm-hmm.
when did it first enter the system. And we actually do versioning as well. So what this means is that you can actually look at an old result and realize, well, this result was created by an old version of the workflow. And
mm-hmm.
you have the ability to say, well, I'd like to actually rerun the new version on that old data set to see if it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But again, with Trident, we capture the execution provenance for a workflow, so you know exactly how your result was created. We capture provenance on the workflows themselves, so you know who created that workflow and who's touched it since it entered our system. And if you're thinking about building a tool that can support a community where you may not necessarily know where the code come from, but if you click on it, you can say, oh, I trust that postdoc. That's one of my students, was one of my students, or I know this person, and the system has been used, that workflow has been used 1,000 times in the last year. I guess I probably should trust that maybe there is something interesting going on in the ocean
yeah.
versus this entered the system yesterday, uploaded by some postdoc who I don't know.
Yeah. I've been reflecting on A couple of things that, in general, I think Microsoft is bringing to the world of science in these, in yours and in other of these collaborations that I've been talking to people about. And one of them is clearly, as we've discussed here, this kind of special competence and expertise in data and data manipulation and data processing, because that's not, I think, really typically a sort of core competence of even computationally oriented scientists, right? Who I think a lot of times, are well, they're computationally oriented, right? But they're not necessarily data oriented, right? And so that's one. But this other aspect is one that comes kind of from the world of computer science, where there's a reasonably strong tradition of version control and reproducibility. But again, I think that's probably that probably hasn't been a sort of a traditional strength of a lot of scientists. And so, this looks like a really fruitful partnership on both of those fronts.
Indeed, I agree with you. I think our ability to not only understand how we're going to have to instrument the systems to capture this provenance, but how we're going to actually store the data not only from the instruments but actually the provenance data itself, because both are a challenge. In fact, some cases there have been studies that have shown that provenance data can actually outweigh, in terms of size, if we're not careful, the relative to the size of the original data, just simply because of the number of steps that are used to process the data. A few bits of data in can result in megabytes of provenance data.
Do you want to kind of go through a little bit of an example of how this is actually being used, or do you want to save that for the screencast?
On how it's being used, I think it would be ideal to talk about that in the screencast.
Okay.
Something else we'd like to be able to do is to get Catherine Van Ningen, or perhaps Alex Soleil, to chime in on how it's also being used for astronomy, because what that will give you, while Neptune is certainly a focus for our group, what's surprisingly it's happening outside of this is that we're giving drops of this code to other researchers or people in our e-science research group who are actually using this with other scientists.
I'd actually love to talk with Alex. I did a couple of extremely in-depth conversations about the World Wide Telescope, one with Curtis Wong, but the other one with Jonathan Fay. And so we kind of touched on a lot of the work that Alex had done. And that would be great, actually, too. So he's using your stuff as well?
Not himself personally, his project is, his
Okay.
PanSTARRS project is.
Okay.
Catherine Van Ningen and Yogesh Simon are basically co-architects of PanSTARRS with Alex, are actually bringing workflow to the table so that now when Alex writes papers on what his PanSTARRS architecture looks like, workflow is prominently featured as the way that scientists describe how to upload their data into PanSTARRS and get it out of. And Trident is the workflow engine that's being used. So looking forward in the future, I mean, I think you must be hearing little bits and pieces about other activities that we have here in external research. Perhaps the scholarly communications aspect of our
Yep,
work.
I've actually talked with Pablo about his project, and actually just earlier last week I had a kind of an overview discussion with Tony Hay about
Wonderful.
a whole sort of so that kind of that's kind of creates a frame
Right.
around
Well, I
these
mean,
bits and
so the
pieces.
one thing I'd like to add is when you think about Trident, also in the context of scholarly communications, and what you picked on as in terms of provenance as being very important, because I think we see eye to eye on this, is this idea that not only will you be able to use tools that we create here for e-science, for data manipulation, and for your experimentation, but we're focusing on reproducible research, where when Trident is completed, has finished executing, we will create an XML structure that basically describes how to call back into Trident to recreate a result. And we're really keen on this idea of in the future we could imagine having an impact on how science is done. Is not only do we provide tools to make it easier to do the science, not only make it easier for tools to publish the science, but also reproduce the science, where and we're able to actually embed this XML execution script into a Word document, or really, we should be able to put it into PDF or any other document that can carry this forward. A reproducible script for calling back into the original engine to recreate a result. And that I think is very exciting. This is something that's been talked a lot about in the computational sciences, but there's never been an organization who's tried to address the end-to-end. For a community thing here, we're giving tools. These tools are instrumented. They produce an XML standard that the community can own, for describing how the science was created on tools that are publicly available, and that gets carried along with the publication, either physically or by reference, and we store this execution script in a database somewhere.
It's a really, really big idea.
It is, and I think it can be transformational. And right now, reproducibility is if you happen to know the individual who did the result, or if you happen to capture enough stuff down in your lab notebook or scribbled on your whiteboard, you have a chance of being able to do it. But imagine being able to click any result, and automatically and transparently to you, the redo script was captured to go along with that, to reproduce that result.
Yep. Or, I mean, in reality, it's not necessarily going to just be punch a button and everything happens exactly the way that it did. But having the documentation at that level of detail and in that form would be, just an incredible asset.
Yes, agreed. So that to me is really exciting. It starts to pull the pieces together. And the hope is that also with external research, because we're building these tools in the context of not just one science project, but multiple, you can actually give community tools that could actually bridge communities. I mean, when talking to people in the earth sciences who are doing atmospheric studies, the similarity of the workflows and the type of analysis they're trying to do is so similar to what the oceanographers are trying to do. But right now, since those two communities are not talking or sharing tools, it's very difficult for one community to interact with the other. So there's a hope some synergy will happen there.
That's a really nice point. Good deal. All right. Well, thanks so much, Roger.
All right. Talk to you later.